Session number 7363, George Jameson, tape one.
Mr. Jameson, could I start off by asking you something about your background? Whereabouts were you born and brought up?
Well, I was born in Newcastle on Tyne. My father was a civil servant. He was fairly well placed in the post office service, and rather a promising career ahead of him. There were four of us, my brother, me, and then two sisters, eventually. And we all started off in the usual sort of schooling of those times, until we were old enough to go to something better. And then my father, who was a very handsome-looking man, my mother, who was a very strong person and very capable dealing with accountants, solicitors, and people like that, my grandfather having quite an estate that she used to help him with. She, of course, was doing quite a lot of work for my grandfather, and as a result of that, I think at that time made more money than my father did at that time, which I don't think by hindsight was a good situation in a way. My father, of course, used to get flattered by a lot of these girls in the business, in the post office where he was, and I think he eventually cleared off. I think I was about 10. Oh, yes, he did. But I think after about 12 months, or anyhow, inside 2 years, he was sufficiently regretful about the move he'd made to want to come back again. But my mother was a very strict Victorian, and I think it made a mistake. I think from our point of view, I think she made a mistake because, you see, it had been planned that my brother and I would go off to boarding school. We'd probably have gone to Durham School, but as it turned out, we went to Dame Allen's school in Newcastle, which was the cathedral school. And fortunately there, he got a first-class scholarship in the school within, well, when he'd been there a very short time, and in the next 12 months I got one. And as a result of that, my mother was able to send my two sisters to Dame Allen's girls' school, which he probably wouldn't have been able to afford otherwise. So that was my schooling days.
Did you have an OTC at school?
No, regrettably, I was very keen on something of the sort, and I used to look with envy at the RGS, who had this marvelous playing field, you know, and all that. And Dame Allen's was in the middle of town, in a building which is a conserved building now, and was given over to the Education Authority at one time. I don't know what it's doing now. No, all I did at school was, my brother used to play football, and I was mainly keen on swimming. So I used to, we had a Northumberland baths adjoining, and we used to go there twice a week. And we had the schoolboy champion at our school at the time, and I came second to him in the two-length race, I remember. We used to be, after the swimming sports, we used to be given season tickets or books of tickets as prizes, which were marvelous. At the school sports, my brother won the Victor Ludorum, which my sister-in-law gave to the school only recently. She thought they might like to use it as a sort of prize. And when my father, well, by the time my father walked out, my brother, who was by that time able to leave school, he told my mother he was going to get himself a job. He went straight off and got himself into the coal trade in Newcastle, and gradually built up a very good position there. I was a sort of harum-scarum type, you know. I had a bicycle, and I used to half crown in my pocket and two or three of my pals, and we'd go off into the country and sleep in barns and all sorts for the weekend, that sort of thing. Generally, I liked the open-air life, and I was very keen on OTC things. of course, hadn't been able to. Well, when eventually they, my last year at school, I remember, I enlarged a little drawing out of a Harmsworth magazine of the shamrock, and with the drawing master's help, produced lines for this thing, and in the wood workshop, made a model about so big, which one of the masters wanted to buy from me when I was leaving, but I didn't sell it. Not very stupid, because I never did anything with it. But they then conceived the idea. My a friend of ours, Andrew Parkinson, was the chief designer's private secretary at Armstrong's, and he had a very good job. And he got me in there as an apprentice. So I went into Armstrong Shipyard as an apprentice to learn the business. And in Armstrong's, they had the shipyard and the ordnance works and the steel works all along the river. At the ordnance works end, they had an old wooden ship called the Calliope, which the ordnance people used to, most of them were naval reserves, you see, on there. At our end of the building, the yard manager, George Carter, was Colonel George Carter, and he was the territorial major of the Elzig Battery, which had featured in the South African War. And they had a drill hall along there. And while I was still underage to join either one or other of these things, I used to gravitate between one and the other. One time my boots would be black while I went to the Navy job, you see, and I used to get on the river in cutters and things and do rowing, and I've got a memento of that on here, because I was on the deck there one time when they were doing, had a dummy breech and they were loading shells into it, and this one fella missed this thing and it bounced off and hit my big toe, and the result is I have practically no nail on there now. The other side of... Then, of course, I came to the conclusion my eyesight wasn't going to be good enough for the Navy anyhow. So I got along to the other end. And there I used to frequent the drill hall and learn how to polish saddlery and harness and stuff. And then the senior apprentices who were able to join a territorial unit joined the battery. And... one of the head people in the shipyard was very friendly with the riding master at the local field battery, the barracks there, where there was a field brigade. And he arranged with this man that these fellows would go up there at 6 o'clock in the morning and take out a pair of horses for the gun teams on exercise. These strings of battery horses used to go off in pairs all around the town moor and around the north side of Newcastle at a hard trot. Two bridles and a numna on the ride horse, and that was all, you see. And if you got a razor back, you knew about it by the time you got back. So they used to go off on this sort of thing, and I gradually got myself edged into this, although I still wasn't old enough to join the territorials, but I got some riding instruction. The first thing I can remember getting into the riding school up where the master with a long rip used to send you going round. Well, the horses knew more about the job than we did. And when he was growling in the bottom of his throat when they were going round in file, you see, he said, "Now I'm going to send you round the school in file." And he said, "When I give the order, I want you to all sink, turn right and move across the school and then turn left and go round on the other hand." And... when he was just going like this to get right turn out, the horses were round. And I can remember going round this corner with one foot in the air and myself round the other side of its neck. You see? But gradually, you see, you get worn into it. You learn by the hard way. And I kept at it. And then eventually I was able to join. So I joined the Elzig Battery. And by the time I'd done 3 years in there... it was just 12 months before the war broke out then. My friends were joining the Northumberland Yeomanry, Northumberland's house. And I thought, well, that's better than this, because I was on the battery staff in the battery. I did have a horse as a signaller. I'd qualified as a first-class signaller, tossed flags about, and but I thought it would be far better to be in the yeomanry. You know, have all my pals outside were in there. So as soon as my period was up in the artillery, I switched straight away and joined the yeomanry. And it was 18 months after the first year of the yeomanry, we were at Lord Ridley's place in north of Newcastle on his park. And then the year of the war, we were at Farnley Park at Otley. And strangely enough, we were alongside the Scots Greys. And of course, we used to go off and collect raw horses from all over the place for these camps. And they had to break them in and get them used to troop work. And while we were standing, one of these troops of Scots Greys were standing having a smoke while we were trying to perform in Farnley Park. And they were having a quiet snigger. And their bloke came over to Eustace Smith. He was Smith's docks on the Tyne. And said, Philip, my fellas are taking a quiet little gander at your blokes, but, you know, they don't know what you're up against, do they? He said, I'm going to suggest to you that what we do is we line our fellas up and we walk together and swap horses, and they take over your lot, and then we watch them do it. So we stood and had a very good laugh at them. And then afterwards, of course, we met them in the canteen after that. And we had one fellow marshal who was, he was with Ned Clark, a very noted solicitor in the North Circuit. And Marshall was a beer drinker without any swallow. So he could pick a pint of beer up and just do that, and it went straight down. You see, there was none of this at all. And these fellows were standing, these Scots Greys were standing around in this place where they were having a quiet drink, and they were betting on who could shift about three or four pints off the counter. And we said, well, we think we've got a fellow who could stand up to any of your blokes. And we got Marshall onto this. And we won a lot of money off them. So we got very well respected. Then, of course, I was away and with the family, we were on holiday on the Solway in Silloth when the war broke out. And I got calling up papers, of course, to go and join the yeomanry. We were taken from there to Gosforth Park, which was the race course in Newcastle on Gosforth. And strangely enough, that's where I now go and dine with the old boys' school reunion. But we went there and we lived in the jockeys' accommodation, and our horses were all parked in the loose boxes on the race course. Lord Ridley, of course, was too old to go overseas. We, the yeomanry, were called the Northumberland Hussars Imperial Yeomanry, and a condition of their service was that they were volunteered for overseas service at any time, immediately. There was no question of it. They wore these little imperial service badges. So, of course, when the war broke out, Lord Ridley resigned from the post, and an ex-lifeguardsman, Colonel Cookson, took command. Colonel Cookson had a bit more pull, of course. Rumour has it, I can't think, however, we might have got the job any other way. Peter Cookson had a bit of pull with the staff in London. He'd been for years commanding lifeguards. And he went up there and said, look, we've got to have a job from you people. And it turned out, I think I'm right in saying, that Sir John French had been, as a junior officer, he'd been adjutant of the Northumberland Hussars in his early service years, and he remembered that. So Peter Cookson persuaded him to give us a job. Well, as soon as we'd got horses and whatnot, we went to Lyndhurst in the New Forest, and we were sent there, and given we were appointed to be divisional cavalry to the 7th Division. which was forming in the New Forest. These second battalions were all coming from abroad and being regimented into the 7th Division. We were there. Until, let's see, the war broke out on August the 4th. We were in Gosforth Park all of August and part of September. September and all of September we were in the New Forest. And then the division, the 7th Division, went overseas from Southampton, intended for the relief of the Naval Division, who were penned up in Antwerp. We, as divisional cavalry, I remember we went on the SS Minneapolis. Strangely enough, it turned out that our commissionaire was an RAMC sergeant on it, on the same boat, and I didn't find it out till he got a job with us over there. It's funny how things turn out. But yes, we went off, and eventually we landed at Zeebrugge on the Mole, intending to go to the relief of Antwerp. But of course, one division opposed by a German army corps just wasn't on. And we'd gradually drifted sideways from Zeebrugge. I can remember an amazing incident. We arrived on the Mole in the dusk, and by the time we'd got our horses off and everything off, the town was in darkness. And the clatter, there wasn't a light anywhere. There wasn't a person on the streets anywhere. And we were riding through the town, and the clatter of the hooves brought all the doors open, all the lights on, and girls and wives and men came rushing out, embracing us, and bottles of wine, loaves of bread, and everything were thrust upon us. You talk about a triumphal entry, it wasn't, did it? Well, we rode from there, and eventually pulled up. The first stop was a pulled up in a place called Cool's Camp. It was beautiful weather. Our squadron were in an enormous field, and our squadron horse lines were in a box formation in this field. The saddlery was off at the hedges, and we wrapped up in blankets and sleeping in the saddle behind them. And with us in the jimmy cart, one fellow called Billy Elliott and another one called Alf Carrick were both members of the Gosforth Amateur Dramatic Society. And Alf Carrick had a marvellous light baritone voice. And Billy Elliott had taken his fiddle. And away over on the far side, it was a lovely night, lying there in the just some crunching of the horses, you know, the chopping going on at the hay bags and whatnot. And the bright, clear night, and the moon up above. Most impressionable, I thought. You wouldn't have thought there was a war on. Away on the far side of the field, and four troop he was, now it's number two, Alf Carrick started to sing from Cavaliere Rusticana or something like that. And Billy Elliott got his fiddle out and started to play. And they went all through those things that night, playing this stuff, and there we were just lying under the stars, you know, and you couldn't believe it. It was a most impressionable thing. I was always very fond of music like that, and it was really lovely to listen to. And the setting was absolutely wonderful. Well, we pushed on from there. We arrived at Bruges, and we were... All I can remember of Bruges was that we slept in a garden room which was full of beautiful oil paintings on the floor there, while we gradually moved on through Besselaer to Ypres. I have in there, in that book, I have photographs of the squadron, the regiment in fact, arriving in the square at Ypres, in there. The date is the 13th, I think, the 13th of October. And now that, I read a book by someone in the Imperial War Museum, a lady.
Lynn MacDonald, would it be?
No, it wasn't Lynn MacDonald. This one was something about the history of the First World, the battles of the First World War, or something like that. She's an OBE or something. She's just recently, and not very long ago, retired from there. But however, they knew about her when I met. In fact, it was what's his name, who names fade out of my mind every now and then, you know.
Clive Hughes.
It was Clive Hughes who told me about it and sent me the name, and I got the book and read it. Now, she lists the arrival of troops and all the various battles, the numbers and the troops and who they were, what they were into, so forth, as a preamble to talking about the engagements. And it had always been, and I had a bar with what's that fellow's name, who used to comment, the commentator for the Royal British Legion's do at the Albert Hall, the man who always tells you about every regiment's coming in and reciting the various people and who they were entering the hall and forming up. And he said, this is the, forget the number of the London regiment, but this was the London Scottish that were coming in. And he happened to say the first territorial regiment in action. So I heard this and I thought, ooh. I wrote to him and I said, you'll excuse my correcting you, but they were not the first territorial regiment in action. I said, I've got lists of all the expeditionary forces and their composition. The London Scottish and the Oxfordshire Yeomanry were the territorial units in the First Army. They went to the Marne, but they were never in action. They were on lines of communication all the time. Now, the first time the London Scottish were in action was the end of October, and I had two schoolmates in that lot that came up there. We had come out of the line, the 7th Division had come out, and we were sort of standing by on the roadside when they passed us going in. And I spoke to Edwin Laidlaw, and very regrettably, he was killed the next day. But I said, that's the way things happen. But I said, that was their first. Now I said, you needn't take my word for this. Get this book. And I gave him the title of it and the authors. And I said, on page so-and-so, you will see the appearance of the British troops in Ypres. And it tells you that the Northumberland Hussars Yeomanry arrived in the square there. There was a cavalry division arrived in, but they were just in for a few minutes and went out. But the yeomanry were in the place on the 13th of October, and they were there with the 7th Division then right up until they were relieved at the end of October when the 4th Corps came up, and the London Scottish went into action about the 31st of October, and that was their first crack. So he said, well, I don't know if I ever mentioned that at the time, but he said, I'll take your word for it, and I'll certainly read the book. Not Ramsay MacDonald. What the devil was his name? Yes, he always runs the commentary on the British Legion do at the Albert Hall.
On television.
Oh dear, it's on the tip of my tongue, and I can't bring it off. Yeah. His name is Raymond Baxter. Then, yes.
Yes. Before I ask you about the battles, your experience in France in detail, I wonder if I could go back to the period in England before you actually went to France and ask you, first of all, when war broke out, when the 1914-18 war broke out, had you any idea what war was going to be like? What sort of images of war had you then?
No. My only recollection of anything to do with the war had been the Boer War. When my father had taken us to... we had relations who were in the Northumberland Yeomanry then. One brother was a captain and the other one was a trooper. George and Fred Spencer. They were in the Northumberland Yeomanry, and they'd been in South Africa. And my father took us to the barracks to meet them when they'd come home from South Africa, and I was about this high, you see. That's the only recollection I'd had of any war at all, and of course I'd read stories about the war, and as a boy I thought it was an amazing, marvellous thing, you know. And You got all these stupid ideas about the glory about it and all that rubbish. But there it was. Yeah, that was the impression I had. And when I got these call-up papers, of course, Mother was on a flap. We were all up there together on the Solway, Silith. And I said, oh, that's all right, Mother, don't you worry. I'll be all right. You don't know why worry about me. And, of course, I used to say that every time she came down when we went to Gosforth Park and were there. They used to come to see us. And then when I used to come home on leaves and go back, you'd say the same. Don't worry, Mother, I'll be home. You don't have to worry about me. And, of course, being the second son, my brother, you see, being a reserved occupation in the coal trade, and at Balbeck Hall there in Newcastle, he was the second man to Guthrie, the secretary. He'd, of course, when I was in the territorials before the war and that sort of thing, he'd always laughed at me and my tin soldiers and whatnot, you see, and scoffed away at us. He was a very quiet sort of... When my father cleared out, you see, he was quite automatically the elder brother and the one who would take charge. And Mother looked up to him. He's a very good-looking fellow and very quiet and responsible-looking fellow, you see. So she sort of played up to him, and of course he was the elder son. And then we did have a mother's help in the place who took a bit of a shine to him, and we were scared stiff that he would go and do anything silly, you see. And we were damn glad when eventually he got off to the war and he forgot her. But that's a sideline.